What is happening now is, I call it lawlessness, because, you know, you cannot find or seek any protection anywhere.
The regime is not willing to start any negotiations. They think they are in control of the situation as long as they apply repressions.
The authorities are kind of trying to show that they don't really care, you know, they're not scared of the sanctions, but at the same time, they're asking to not to impose the sanctions.
I think the most kind of problematic part behind it all, that they don't have a future vision of Belarus. They don't offer a positive agenda in any kind of way.
Welcome to another episode of The Naked Pravda, Medusa's only English language podcast. I'm Eilish Hart, the news editor for Medusa in English, and this week I've put together an episode that looks back on the past 6 months of opposition protests in Belarus. The protests began in August 2020, when election officials declared that Alexander Lukashenko had won his sixth consecutive presidential term. The mass demonstrations were met with a violent police crackdown, which, in combination with the onset of winter, led opposition protesters in Belarus to adopt new tactics for expressing their discontent. To find out more about the current political situation, I invited two experts on the show to talk about how the opposition movement has evolved and how Lukashenko's regime has managed to withstand the protests. We started our conversation by talking about the All Belarusian People's Assembly, a congress of delegates from across the country that takes place every 5 years. This year's event was held on February 11th and 12th, the same week the opposition protests entered their sixth month.
It was the first major event since the elections for the regime. So for them, institutionally, they were setting quite a lot of expectations for different societal groups in Belarus.
That's Maria Rojova, a doctoral researcher at the University of Oslo, whose work focuses on symbolic politics and identity in post-Soviet autocracies.
Previously, there were talks about that they will announce certain constitutional reforms. They were also creating different expectations that they would offer certain concessions, institutional concessions. So overall, there was this kind of moment from the elections leading to this specific event. But I think it's also important kind of as a symbolic kind of aspect of what it represented. From a more symbolic perspective, I think they were trying to create a gesture that is aimed at the remaining supporters of the regime in Belarus. So they were presenting it to people who were not vocal, who were quite rather silenced by the protesters. So they were trying to show, there is a forum for you. So they created, you know, special bags for them. They created as well a buffet from them. So they are as well trying to kind of market as their own kind of place, and they were talking directly to this specific audience. But at the same time, all this kind of things that we expected from this assembly didn't create a moment for the regime later. So they announced kind of constitutional changes that were not even presented. Again, there were talks about that there will be a constitutional amendment. It will be drafted. They also didn't bring any specific timeline of any kind of constitutional changes. So overall, I think it was just mostly a symbolic, very propaganda type of event that created a lot of media noise in Belarusian state media.
It sounds like this is kind of an event for Lukashenko to get up and kind of speak to his political base. Is there anything concrete that he's offering them in terms of incentives, I guess, to legitimize his presidency and keep him in power?
I don't think that they are offering anything at this moment. I think mostly they offer that basically if you offer your consent or you are complicit in supporting this regime, so this kind of complicity will be protected by the regime. So I think here mostly it marks that they are ready to protect them in many different ways, and they are able to show that they will create them those safe kind of spaces if they're willing to commit to this propaganda messages, to the statement that the official line proposes. Those who are not complicit, they should live in danger. They, you know, they might be fines, it might be administrative arrest. People could, you know, can knock on your doors at any time. But here with us, you're kind of in this kind of safe harbor.
I asked a similar question about the purpose of this year's All Belarusian People's Assembly to Hanna Lubakova, a journalist from Belarus who's also a non-resident fellow at the Atlantic Council think tank.
Basically, that assembly was kind of a session of group therapy. Like, it was important, obviously, for several reasons. Firstly, because Lukashenko promised that the assembly would discuss the constitutional reform, and it did. Some details about the reform appeared only towards the end of his speech. So he's kind of postponing even conversations about possible amendments. And obviously Belarusians expected it to be sooner, but the reason why Lukashenko is postponing the reform is because he feels stronger and more confident now, so he doesn't feel that he needs to change anything. Another kind of important aspect of that assembly, it was supposed to be a national inclusive dialogue. Lukashenko himself promised that the entire spectrum of opinions on what's happening in the country would be presented at the assembly. In reality, however, no Lukashenko's opponent was present. There were several messages to Russia sent during the assembly. It's obviously because Lukashenko understands how important is to kind of keep the Kremlin on his side. And he kind of himself many times appealed to Putin, saying that they are in the same boat against this, you know, collective West presented as the enemy, and that protests in Russia are a continuation of the protests in Belarus. So it's important to fight it together. Also, Lukashenko mentioned the conditions under which he would leave. And he said that he would leave if the protests stop, and that there would be guarantees for him and his closest circle. But I would say that, well, people in Belarus do not necessarily believe in such promises because, well, Lukashenko, we all know that it's obviously in his interest that the protests stop, so that he can say that, you know, it's all fine in the country and there is no dissent anymore. And I would say that it might have been a message to Russia again, you know, that, you know, there is some area, there is some room where he can actually reach a compromise and kind of show that he's ready to leave, or he's ready to have a constitutional reform, whatever. In reality, he would postpone it as long as he can. I would say that, you know, the assembly also has shown that Lukashenko is not ready for more serious concessions. He's ready to talk about some potential, you know, steps, but it doesn't mean that they would happen. And the less specific steps he says, proposes, offers, the longer it allows him to kind of stay in power. Because if he only talks about possible change, it doesn't mean that this would happen. He can, you know, keep talking about this for years. In general, his closest circle, as much as they are loyal, obviously, to him, and I mean his power vertical officials and security forces, this is not a monolithic system. There are clear divisions between them. Many people defected. Many people left. Also, there are different departments in security forces, from, you know, obviously investigators, prosecutors, to this OMON, GUBOPIK, you know, all these kind of most hardcore law enforcement security forces departments who really committed crimes. So he generally during the assembly said that they also need to have guarantees. So it is clear that he would defend them as long as he can. And as you know, a no criminal case was started that would investigate the murders, deaths of protesters. So it means that Lukashenko is trying to cover, you know, what they did. And when it comes to officials, again, right, there are obviously, you know, those most loyal ones, but they would also see at some point that the crisis has to be solved. There is this cumulative effect, you know, of people maintaining pressure, imposing pressure on Lukashenko, the authorities, on you know, kind of again, security forces, power vertical, and this would increase, this would grow, and there would be a moment at some point when they would have to deal with it, not only fighting with those visible reasons of kind of visible signs of the distance, such as protests, but also fighting with actual reasons for people why they are coming out on the streets.
People have been protesting in various forms for the past 6 months. As a journalist, what has it been like covering a protest movement for such a long period of time?
Well, it's hard for many reasons. The situation, when it comes to media freedom, the situation in Belarus was never good, was never optimistic. It was always dire. But I think since even before the elections, actually, not only since August last year, but even before the elections, I would say that the a real war against journalism has started. As you know, in May, in June, like months before the elections, bloggers and journalists were already arrested. And then it just continued. We journalists, when we report on the streets, we are being detained for taking part in a protest, even though we have, you know, all these identification signs, you know, that we are journalists, we are press. So they are clearly targeting us. There is now a trial against those prominent journalists, both TV journalists, Katerina Andreeva and Daria Shiltsova, who just reported, live streamed from an apartment about a rally that was happening on the street, but they were not even there. And they are being accused of organizing, this kind of riots and disrupting public order. And today, on Tuesday, February 16, there is a massive attack on journalists, human rights defenders all across the country. More than 30 people are being searched. Their apartments are being searched. So the authorities are just clearly trying to desert the field. They're trying to ruin any infrastructure, any ecosystem, like anything that is kind of still active, still exists and still kind of helps people. They searched the office of the Belarusian Association of Journalists, which is one of the most important, professional organization of journalists in Belarus that really helped a lot, many journalists, including myself. And people are, journalists, my colleague, are just targeted, obviously. They have been targeted with rubber bullets, with tear gas. They also experienced police violence, and they are kind of targeted intentionally, like someone who is kind of active, who is prominent, well-known, might be just detained.
Going after the media is a very kind of clear response that the authorities have had to the opposition movement. And then obviously the demonstrations have been violently suppressed. What other tactics are the authorities using to try and kind of quell dissent?
Whatever organization or infrastructure or platform exists, it's active and helps people, it's well known and people use it, the authorities are just trying to crack down on it. Whatever activity is happening, the authorities are cracking down on it. Only this weekend, at least 100 people have been detained. And among those people were Imagine, Fox, who just attended a concert. So the authorities just all of a sudden thought that it's just very dangerous. And, this more than 60 people have to be detained. And also like a few dozen people who went skiing. So they're just, they're just detaining people. And there are cases, there are this, hundreds, dozens of videos that we received, from different cities, from different towns, showing that people are just being detained for basically, just going out, living their apartments. And this is this atmosphere of fear that the authorities are creating. It works in some way because, firstly, people just don't feel safe. They don't feel secure. And because they receive so much information about these repressions, happening all over the country, they also feel powerless. What is happening now is, I call it lawlessness, because, you cannot find or seek, any protection anywhere. The court will not defend you. The police will not defend you. So that's kind of how it's working, and what effect it actually has on people, right? At the same time, it also doesn't work because people just understand like that if they stop, that would be even worse. And there is this, so now they're applying these guerrilla methods. They, put stickers or hold white, red, white flags and then, or go in shopping malls and sing you know, some kind of national traditional songs, and then they disperse immediately so that they are not detained. But kind of when it happens in dozens of places, it still imposes a lot of pressure because it just shows that people are not ready to give up. And they, you know, still kind of show their discontent. What's also important, what's happening now, is that, you know, all these kind of courts and trials are happening. And it will be, you know, there will be more of those. There are currently more than 250 political prisoners, but there are also almost 2,000 criminal cases, you know, that were launched against you know, peaceful protesters or, you know, just people, activists, you know, who took part in rallies. And what, are we going to end up with more than 2,000 political prisoners? Well, that's a good question.
Are these cases from recent arrests, or is it just that the judicial system is just getting to them?
Any court, you know, any publicity, well, firstly, obviously brings people's attention to the case of this person, but also provokes more criticism from abroad, from the West, you know, from Western organizations. And if this case, if the authorities give up on the case and this person is released, it shows a signal that, you know, for people that they are, kind of don't have to be afraid, you know, that they can continue protesting because it's still possible that the authorities are releasing someone. If this case is brought to the court and this person is given 8 years in prison or 5 years in prison, whatever, it also kind of forces those international organizations to pose sanctions or whatever pressure they can impose, right? Or just say that they're deeply concerned. But still, kind of, they are, again, postponing this process as much as they can. So that's why not so many political prisoners are being on trial. The authorities are trying to leave some room for themselves. Trading of political prisoners is something that Lukashenko has been doing for years. And there are signs that he is coming back to the same procedure, to the same idea. The more, you know, he's not decisive, the more he, the longer he postpones the actual decision, kind of the better for him, obviously. But it also, it doesn't mean that we have to, as the international community, that we have to follow kind of the same logic. I'm just afraid that the West would see some signs of progress because he would release one person or two. This cannot happen because, well, these are not only political prisoners, these are hostages.
Pressure and threats from the authorities have driven a number of Belarusian opposition figures to flee the country, including Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, who became Lukashenko's main political rival during the 2020 presidential elections. Tikhanovskaya is now living in exile and leading a unified opposition from Lithuania. So I asked my guests to explain how Tikhanovskaya's role in the opposition movement has changed over the last 6 months.
I think her role involved with the results of the election. So she received additional legitimacy, not from the official results, but basically, but from a public mobilization campaign after the election. So we still don't know the official results, but the massive election fraud and additional election observation helped to indicate the public opinion that she actually managed to mobilize voters and gain quite a lot of votes in this election. So this definitely helped to legitimize her status as a leader of her kind of democratic movement or protest movement in Belarus. But then, of course, this period in post-election that resulted in her forced exit from the country was also problematic. It was, it followed by a number of arrests of leading figures in Belarus, and we ended up with almost all leaders either behind bars or in exile. So she I think, took here a leadership role in establishing herself in a foreign policy dimension. Her office mainly deals with representation and the lobbying of Belarusian interest in foreign policy, so meetings with foreign leaders and different international organizations who might as well help to maintain Belarus on the political agenda and to discuss sanctions or different initiatives that might help Belarusians and the protest movement in a position. There is, of course, different dynamics. So there is this kind of one type, which is institutionalized movement who supported her. On the other side, the protest movement became quite diverse, really representing different groups and people who were protesting for not just against the regime, but against the violence, against this massive repressions and ill treatment in detention centers. So they might have as well different opinion on who might represent them. Overall, I see right now that yes, there's still Svetlana Tikhanovskaya represent an important part of Belarusian society. So people who are active protesters, people who still fight against the regime, but she might not represent all people involved in the protest mobilization since August.
It's very hard to communicate with people because, well, many are just afraid to get in touch, you know, to have any contacts. And despite that, well, Svetlana Tikhanovskaya's team and herself, they have calls literally every week with different social groups inside the country, such as medical workers, students, academics, striking workers, and generally kind of, you know, workers at state-owned enterprises, and so on, like many, many, many social groups. So this is important. Like, this means that there is this connection, you know, between those people who are based in Vilnius abroad, or Warsaw, or Riga, whatever place that they are based, you know, with those people on the ground. So there is kind of this still some feedback. The work that Svetlana Tikhanovskaya is doing on the international arena is very important. And actually, if we look at those small victories, at those kind of pieces or examples of success that happened throughout these 6 months. This is also very important. You know, there is this huge kind of delegitimization of Lukashenko. He was not accepted as the legitimate leader, and the election results were not accepted. While Svetlana Tikhanovskaya and the Coordination Council were kind of acknowledged as the representatives of the people. Also, when it comes to economic pressure or generally pressure, right, there have been 3 rounds of sanctions and some other kind of decisions that were made. Svetlana Tikhanovskaya's office, the Coordination Council, the National Anti-Crisis Management, they are trying to mobilize this Western kind of reaction, and they're trying to keep Belarus in the agenda. So this is all very important. And this is something that was not done before, I mean, to that extent at least. So this is actually a success. At the same time, more should be done, obviously, inside the country. But this is, you know, something that they also kind of understand, you know, that they have to work with different, you know, groups of people, not only active protesters, but those people who are undecided and so on. It just takes time. And you cannot do it, you know, everything like at the same time, especially if you're based abroad. The fact that Lukashenko is still in power is very logical. It's very natural. I mean, I did not honestly, rationally, kind of realistically, I could not expect him to leave his office so soon. And 6 months is not enough, apparently, to destroy the system. But what has been achieved has to be taken into consideration.
I know Tikhanovskaya recently said that the international community should be braver and stronger, and she's been calling for more sanctions. Do you think the Western sanctions are an effective tool, or is it something that the Belarusian authorities can ignore?
The last round of sanctions, there were so many hopes put into that, you know, those kind of financial sanctions imposed on Lukashenko's oligarchs and state-owned companies. But in reality, this was not enough at all. And many people kind of laughed and mocked, you know, at this round of sanctions, and they did not kind of perceive it as a real support. But even this round of sanctions, the last one, like the authorities are kind of trying to show that they don't really care. You know, they're not scared of the sanctions, but at the same time, they're asking to not to impose the sanctions. So it's kind of, you know, very funny. Sanctions are not effective, but please, could you lift the sanctions?
To be honest, it's a question I always struggle with, because I think sanctions are also this polarized issue among Belarusian experts. So you have people who are absolutely supporting the sanctioned regime, and there are people in Belarusian expert audience who are lobbying against any kind of sanctions, saying that it doesn't really change domestic politics or has no influence on the political regime in the country. It might lead only to consolidation of the regime if you use sanctions. But for me, I think sanctions might not be a political instrument that changes the regime, but it's an important signal that indicates that this behavior is not tolerated or will not be tolerated by foreign leaders. And for this, I kind of value sanctions this way, that we indicate there is a certain red line and you're not supposed to cross this red line. What we have observed from this situation with Belarus is that sanctions work, but it has to be a rapid response. This response has to consider political context. It has to address political players that are important for this regime, and they have to be unilateral. All countries have to agree to this, and quite quickly. And in the situation with Belarus, we have not seen that. So we still see this kind of very rigid, very stiff type of policy that is really hard to change in European foreign affairs. At this moment, I think that most of the time, the European Union only responded to the situation. They were not a proactive type of foreign player who might have helped to shape policies toward Belarus. They always react, and it takes quite a lot of lobbying and foreign policy lobbying from the opposition to initiate those sanctions. And this takes time and quite a lot of energy. And the result is not as painful as it should have been.
Tikhanovskaya has also been, you know, consistently bringing up the idea that the West should facilitate some kind of dialogue or act as a mediator between the opposition and the authorities in Belarus. Is this something that is on the table, or do you think sanctions are eliminating that possibility?
The latest kind of People's Assembly has shown that they are not really open and ready to have negotiations or to have dialogue. But this is something that obviously can be and has to be achieved. This can be achieved, again, through pressure, which we've just discussed, you know, through sanctions or economic pressure or any political pressure. And eventually, this will lead to dialogue and negotiations, because this status quo cannot be maintained. The status quo is too expensive for the regime. You know, they have to invest so much money into security forces or into, you know, kind of not introducing, not doing any reforms. So there has to be a moment when this dialogue will happen. The problem I see now is that there is no political will from the West, and no country region is capable of taking responsibility and introducing a united, unified, strong position towards the solution of the Belarusian crisis. And the time, you know, the time is ticking. Every day is dangerous for Belarusians. You know, throughout the weekend, you know, more than, 100 people were detained, and just people kind of ignore this.
I think what eliminates this possibility is the regime is not willing to start any negotiations. I think they think they are in control of the situation as long as they apply repressions. And I think they just, they consider that Tikhanovskaya has no leverage on domestic situations. So there is no political body inside Belarus which could represent a united opposition. But at the same time, if somebody will try to establish any kind of political body who will represent a united opposition voice, this group will be either jailed or forced again to exile. So overall, I think just no willingness from the regime, because they control the situation. Second is as well, they get quite a lot, Lukashenko gets the backing of Russia. So if there was some push from an important foreign actor, such as Russia, who would force them to either to continue with constitutional kind of reform, or at least start a certain type of dialogue, or at least a forum or something that could create this vision of a dialogue, maybe then they would consider initiating something. But overall, there is no pressure for it from anyone, basically, except of course the European Union and other foreign actors. But from Russia and domestic kind of elites, there is no initiative for this type of dialogue.
In this situation, then, do you think that Russia has more leverage in terms of pressuring the Belarusian authorities to resolve the crisis?
I think that they do have a significant leverage on the regime, because right now there's the only, not the only, but the main backer or the main supporter of Lukashenko. I think overall they are interested in restoring a certain political stability in a way that there is no significant crisis that takes form in massive repression. So I think they just don't want to see the picture of people being detained. They don't want to have that image can be printed in international media, an image that is visible for the international audience. I think they don't want to see that. And in this way, maybe they are interested in resolving the situation. But I think Lukashenko overall kind of provides guarantees that this situation is resolved in a way that there is no more significant massive rallies and so on. So he's able kind of to sell it to Russia, saying that the situation is resolved this way. So it will be interesting whether a new kind of meeting between Lukashenko and Putin will result in kind of new demands for example, for constitutional reform.
While some analysts have argued that the protest movement in Belarus has stalled, others maintain that large-scale demonstrations could resume in the spring. So I asked my guests to weigh in on the likelihood of opposition protesters returning to the streets.
With the current level of repressions, I don't know if people are ready to go out to the streets. It doesn't mean that the discontent has stopped, not at all. It's hard for me to say what would be a right decision to kind of ask people to go out to the streets, you know, knowing that there would be a crackdown, or just postpone this. But I definitely know that this discontent has not stopped. This is confirmed by sociological research, but also that's something that I saw before the election. When I traveled across the country and I went and talked to people all over the, you know, this regional towns in Minsk, they were naming so many reasons. You know, they were telling me why they want Lukashenko to leave. You know, they were tired of him. There were so many economic reasons, the pandemic, and everything. And they wanted change. And even before the election, I knew that, you know, this society has evolved and this society has changed so much. So there is no way back. I'm just kind of seeing this revolution as something that has just started. It's not like in half a year, in several months, you would destroy the system that was built for 26 years. It would take longer, but the society is definitely ready.
I think there are important days coming up. So they are symbolic, not for this specific movement, but they have been symbolic in Belarusian history. So on the 25th of March, there is a Freedom Day, one of the key dates in the history of Belarusian opposition. Several years ago, it was even possible to organize a big concert dedicated to 100 years of establishing Belarusian People's Republic in the center of Minsk. And now, of course, it just feels, you know, not even possible to organize any type of official gathering that will be permitted. So overall, I think we might see some mobilization, but the repressions are so massive that I think that people who still remain in Belarus, they might consider consequences of participating. Right now, I think we have to wait until a certain kind of maybe a critical moment or critical event that might happen. At this moment, I see that there is a lot of, like, the data that we receive from public surveys indicates that just there is erosion of public trust in the state institutions. There is erosion of public trust in any kind of, you know, official institutions. So overall, I see significant discontent that, you know, or that just needs a moment or just needs this kind of date to actually erupt. But at the same time, it's hard to predict when it erupts and what will trigger such a significant mobilization as we have observed last year.
So you mentioned survey data. When you're looking at those numbers, is there kind of an indication that society is kind of split and polarized? Or is there like a significant undecided segment of the population in terms of like support for the regime or the opposition?
Well, the data that I have seen in so far indicates a significant polarization of society and significant politicization. What it means is that polarization happens in certain kind of who they support. And there are like even three groups, not just supporters of the government and opposition, but also people who are prefer not to state their opinion. And this group might grow as well with more mass, for example, mass repression or even targeted repressions. The second part is politicization. And this happens that people are much more aware what is happening in the country. So they do read news, they get updates, and they critically engage with information. This is very important because when you have informed public, it's much harder to use propaganda and state propaganda to influence public opinion. So in this way, I think the younger generation, they're much more critically engaged in society. They engage with different sources and different media in getting informed. Overall, this data indicates that, well, right now we have like significant, this kind of three divisions. So there is like around 20 to 30% supporting the current government and 30% supporting the leadership of Tikhanovskaya or the opposition in exile. And another kind of 30% is this kind of undecided, or rather not undecided, but rather silent group.
The institutionalized opposition or the authorities, are either of them trying to appeal to this kind of, like you said, undecided or silent segment of the population in any way?
It's an interesting question. I think they do, by trying to marginalize different oppositional voices. So they use very blunt type of propaganda. Like several days ago, they were trying to put a TV movie with some kind of patriotic lyrics, and then they're trying to portray different people in bad light. So they're trying to marginalize them, but in very blunt and strange manner. I'm not sure how responsive people would be to those messages. But overall, I think it's just, they're trying to appeal, maybe, but in their own way. I'm not sure how convincing this messaging is for this particular group. And I think the most kind of problematic part behind it all, that they don't have a future vision of Belarus. They don't offer anything, a positive agenda in any kind of way. So what they do is they criticize, they try to marginalize, they use as well different conspiracy theories. So overall, maybe it worked in some kind of other moment, but in that moment when you need something positive and a kind of a futuristic a bit vision, they just don't provide it. And being kind of a citizen and a voter, I don't want to buy into something like this. I think that what they should have developed is as well by bringing a new vision, and just don't have it.
Well, for the past years, the Belarusian authorities have stopped communicating with the people, actually. I think after 2015, Lukashenko really kind of started ignoring, you know, what the population, what citizens think, because there were no major protests, and they kind of you know, they did not have any positive agenda. They did not really have anything to offer the people. They don't seem to appealing to anyone, really. You remember the inauguration of Alexander Lukashenko was a secret one. So he invited, what, a few, you know, 100 people and held it just for himself. The assembly was also kind of held for himself. You know, there were 2,700 delegates who were just clapping and, you know, nodding. He did not appeal to the middle class. He did not appeal to businesses. He basically said at the assembly that, you know, everybody can be detained. Just do not protest. You know, we can put you all in prison, which means that he doesn't really care about the economy himself. You know, this revolution is obviously about dignity, about human rights, about political rights, but people also will have to eat. And, you know, the more economic crisis, you know, continues, the more people would be, you know, dissatisfied and kind of not scared, not afraid to lose, you know, their jobs, whatever. His kind of inability to listen to people and to agree to any concessions is also a great mistake of his. So eventually, you know, it will bring more discontent.
Those political repressions, they targeted not only political organizations. They really targeted civil society at large. It's like from cultural initiatives to even businesses that supported actually the opposition and who were involved in strikes or who closed their businesses on certain days. So those actors who shaped quite a lot of, you know, public space. They shaped how Minsk, for example, looked like in recent years. They were forced to close. They were forced to flee or to relocate. And I think in this moment, it's important to kind of reflect who will actually replace them. Whether the spaces will remain empty, whether the regime will, you know, keep those repressions and those places will have to stay completely closed and there will be no new initiatives happening because also there will be no funding for different civil society initiatives via United Nations or European Union or other international organizations. It will have much larger impact on society than we currently consider. So this political crisis affects not just, you know, political freedoms and civic freedoms, but overall this how the country will develop and what we will see afterward, because those initiatives really changed and shaped how young people, for example, saw their future professions, how they engaged in urban kind of environment, how they consumed and so on. So I think there is a kind of larger impact and there is a larger political crisis happening in the country. This is a moment of reflection as well for the people who might not willing to express their opinion, but this is kind of might shape the entire generation of how they engage in politics.
You've been listening to The Naked Pravda, an English language podcast from Medusa, and I hope you'll recommend us to your friends and leave a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you are tuning in to help put this program in front of more people. Thank you for listening and come back soon.